The Who and Behind Blue Eyes, which has been covered many times. Pete Townsend is here to tell us all about it.
Hi, Johnny. How you doing?
Good. You?
Yeah, no, I'm good, yeah.
Now, it's a lovely song, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember doing it. I wrote it at home. And I used to record all my songs at my home studio. I remember my wife, and I went down to get a cup of tea, saying, "That was a nice song," and that's not what she normally said.
She can hear them in the kitchen.
Yeah, she could, yeah. It wasn't very well soundproofed.
Now, the Who are on tour. There's a big tour that rolls through until next year, isn't there? Just all over the place.
That's right. It's our first world tour. And the significance of the world tour really ties to the significance of us having new material for the first time, enough for an album. You know, for many years we've dodged the whole issue, not only of what was going to happen to the future of the band, which just lived up in the astral space, really. The brand name existed, The Who, The Who, The Who, back catalogue, and lots of new fans because of the fact that so many of the modern crop of guitar bands would refer to The Who, and our music got played a lot in movies and in commercials and stuff like that. But the band didn't really exist, it didn't record, but for the first time we've got new material. We've got 15 to 20 tracks to choose an album from. I really felt, you know, we've got new music, let's get out there and do it properly. So let's do the real thing, let's do a big tour, let's play all the territories we haven't played in the past, and let's play the ones we haven't played for a long time, and let's play our favourites too.
Because it's lovely to play the favourites, but it's no fun being a nostalgia band, having that's all you've got, you know, and I'll see you in Hyde Park. And you seem to have really got a nice balance now between the favourites and the new material.
Well, at that kind of show, actually, we wouldn't play much new material, to be honest. I think we only played a couple of things. I think when we're playing to our own fans, we will play, for example, we've got a mini opera coming out called Wire and Glass, that comes out shortly, and that's a 6-song selection of a bunch of songs from a concert piece, and we play that in its entirety. And even our fans kind of go a bit quiet because it's unfamiliar, and then they burst back into life when they hear the diddly diddly refrains of Barbara O'Reilly. You know, the trouble is with a band, I've spoken to lots of people like Macca and Mick Jagger about this stuff. You know, bands of our ilk have a huge familiar legacy of music, which you have to honour. You can't just sort of say, "Oh, I'm only going to." You know, you can't do a Paul Weller on this, let's put it this way. I'm not going back, you know. You have to go back. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to Bowie about it years ago, and he was determined never to play the old hits. He always wanted to reinvent himself. He felt that the familiarity of Bowie was that he was always different. But more recently now, he started to play that old stuff, and I think what actually starts to happen is you start to realise that your audience always has been, and always will be, much, much more important than you are. You know, it's important that they have a good time, not that you have a good time.
Yeah. Now, I think he might have learned something at the Isle of Wight a couple of years ago, because, you know, he did a lot of new stuff and a lot of unfamiliar stuff. And he mentioned Hunky Dory as an album. Here's the most unfamiliar track on it. And I thought, well, you know, why not play the most familiar track on it, you know? And The Who came on and just blew everybody away. It was fantastic.
Well, those kind of festival shows give us an excuse, with a younger audience there, often driven by coming to see their favourite bands, who are often much younger, to play the familiar stuff, you know, and you have to do that. So it's not just that we have the potential to play that stuff and it's familiar, so it kind of they hear it and they recognise it. It's also that we've played it a lot, so we're extremely good at it, you know. So we actually do a good job on it, you know.
Yeah.
But we've got a great band too, you know. We've got, you know, Roger and I have been lucky. When John died in 2002, John Entwistle, our bass player, you know, we had a brief meeting, he and I, and Roger was really ragged with worry, you know. And I've never seen him in such bad shape. And I think what he suddenly thought was, how do we deal with this? You know, when we lost Keith Moon, who was such an extraordinarily distinctive performer and drummer, it was bad enough, and now, of course, we have Zach Starkey working with us, and we have to fight Oasis to get his time, because he works with them as well. But he has a good... he does a good emulation of what Keith used to do in his own brilliant way, and was always a big Who fan. So, but when John died, it was like, oh my God, you know, we really can't now get in a John Entwistle clone. You know, we've, in a sense, we got away with it with Zach, but we wouldn't get away with it again. You know, somebody up there going, you know, the kind of unbelievably huge, massive bass noise. You know, people normally expect bass to go boom, boom, boom. You know, John was just like a, like a screaming heavy metal guitar player, lead guitar player.
But you're on the eve of a US tour. The stadiums are booked. It's all booked. You would let down so many people. In a way, you didn't have... The choice was made for you, wasn't it?
You know, the choice was not made, no, because I think, in a sense, the decision then was, would it be disrespectful to go on? So it was quite a difficult decision. And, but we decided... You know how I made the decision, because it was left to me in the end. Roger said, you make the decision and I'll do whatever you want to do. And I paced the floor all night in L.A. and John's body was still up in Las Vegas where he died, and the tour was about to start at the Bollywood Bowl. It was supposed to have started in Las Vegas, of course, but we had this big gig and I thought, you know, actually, this is, again, this is not about me, it's not about Roger, it's not about John, it's not about John's family, it's not about respect, it's not about dignity, it's not about funerals, it's not about any of that stuff. It's about the fact that we've got fans, you know, and crew, and people have, you know, rearranged their summer to come and see this for whatever crazy reason, and we should try and be there. And so I made one phone call to Pino Palladino. Pino's a bass player that played with me quite a bit on my solo records, and has done one tour with me for Psychedelics in 93, and I knew he knew quite a lot of Who stuff because I'd played it with him, and I thought, well, he would really be good. Made one phone call, got his wife on the phone, she gave me his mobile number, and he'd just been in a studio in Florida, and he was just coming home after 6 weeks away, and I thought, oh God, it's going to be really cruel to ask him to do this, but, and what a scary job. We only had 3 days to rehearse the whole show, that he came in, and I have to say now that, you know, like 4 years later, Pino is starting to relax a bit and we're starting to hear his real vigour. It was a really tense job to come in and do that. And we've got Zach on drums, we've got Rabbit on keyboard, my brother Simon plays a bit of guitar and hits the high notes that I can't do anymore and replaces John's backing vocals, John Entwistle's backing vocals. So we've got a great bunch of guys up there, and their energy helps Roger and I a lot as well.
Well, when you're on stage and you play a new song, you might not hear much coming back from the crowd, but, you know, being in the crowd, you know, I would say it's received well. But obviously they're not going to react in the way they're going to react to a song that they know and love. But people do like to hear the new songs, which is me trying to get a cue into perhaps you thinking of playing one.
Yeah, the one I could play is a song from the Wire and Glass mini opera. The story's really about three kids, I suppose of my kids' age. So people that today would be in their 30s who look back at the 60s and they discover something about 60s music that they find a way to bring to life. And it's they find a way to bring it to life through using the wonder of the internet.
Out on the endless wire, out on
endless while, out on the endless, endless, out on the endless, 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 endless while, out on the endless while, out on the endless, 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 endless while.
Pete Townsend live on Radio 2 with Endless Wire. From the new album that's going to be out in September. I mean, you were talking about the internet and the potential before it was invented, weren't you? You know, way back.
Well, I was actually, I've been given the credit for it and then been kind of like teased for having claimed the credit. I never claimed the credit. What actually happened was is that I talked about going to art school in 61. One of the guys, there was a guy called Harold Cohen. He was the one who foresaw the way that artists would use computers. And it was a result of that teaching that I actually ended up starting to kind of get very visionary about what I thought computers would lead to. And, of course, as soon as you understand how computers work, you understand that they would inevitably be linked up. So it was a kind of an obvious jump to make. But, yeah, on the Who's album, the famous Who album, radio-wise, which is the Who's next album with Won't Get Fooled Again and Barbara O'Reilly and Behind Blue Eyes, that album of songs came from a treatment that I'd written after Tommy, a big concept which was about something a little bit like the internet. It was about the idea that the world would be linked by wire that through which we would interrelate, communicate, but most of all, we would congregate. We would meet each other. We would share art and life, and to some extent what these three kids in my story in Wire and Glass discover is that vision, which of course today we're quite close to. We ain't quite there yet, but we're close to it.
I mean, it used to be great to have a computer and all the things that it could do. Nowadays, if you've got one and it's not coupled to the internet, it's just a lump of, you know, metal. It's, you know, you just get so used to the fact of being connected in.
It's very interesting though, isn't it, for folks like you and I that come really from a world where we depended on radio and television, and it's very, very distinct division from live performance, to realise today that what the internet has done is made us realise that radio and television had one huge, huge, massive advantage over everything else under the sun, which we now rarely use, which is that it can be live. Mm. You know, on the web, my girlfriend and I have got and we had an idea to frame the Who live shows in a webcast, and she started to do a test show, which has turned out a bit like it's a bit like an MTV music chat humour show called In the Attic, and it's on www.thewholive.tv. You can get it. You can log on and see that show, and that's, we've got live clips of the Who and stuff like that. But what's interesting about that is, when we actually do it at the gigs, the shows that we do, it's live. But also the sense that the realness of being live is that it's dangerous. Yes. And the danger of it is that it's real. So, but it's always been there for people of our generation. But somewhere along the line, we started to record things. Because it's convenient, because you can edit and...
Well, I remember the lovely story I heard about The Who was that, you know, that you get signed by a record company, only through them could your music get through to the people. And they would assign the producer and tell you what you should record and everything like that. And that you one day said to the engineer one day, I want to hear that back. And a complete consternation in the control booth between the engineer and the producer. He wants to hear it back. Are we going to let him hear it back? Do we want to let him into the control room?
That's right. I mean,
Now, not only you've got music out on the internet, you've got your TV, and of course, blogs is a great thing, because you're going to have an alternative written media going on out there.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this is using the internet and downloading and music and all of this stuff as a way of, a new way of building a fan club, which has always been huge, power of the fan club.
So the Lifehouse interactive internet site, going live in August, am I right with this?
The Lifehouse method is something else. The Lifehouse method was part of the original story. The method is a software built by a bunch of a guy called Lawrence Ball, who's a harmonic mathematician, and a guy called Dave Snowden, who's a software engineer. They've built this software where you go to a website called the Lifehouse Method, and you log on and you interface with the software, and it gives you a piece of music, which is entirely your own piece of music. Nobody else would produce the same piece of music. You own one third of the copyright, so it can never be sold or moved without your permission. I don't know whether I'm going to charge for it or make it free. I don't know. You can go and check it out now. And yeah, it'll probably really kick off in August, yeah, August or September of this year. But my idea there is that maybe 1,000 people will produce really good, interesting pieces of music, and the software has been constructed in such a way so that all the pieces of music fit together. We think, maybe. So we have this big gathering, invite all these people, we play a bit of the music, we chat to them, we talk to them, we congregate in the flesh, and then we play all the music, and we see what it sounds like. And my notion is that it'll probably sound a bit like the sea, but it could also sound like London on a bad day for when you can't get a taxi in the rain, I don't know.
Going back to Wire and Glass, and these three young people who get into a band, it's interesting that one comes from a family of lapsed Christians, another one is Jewish, the other one is Muslim.
Yeah.
And if you like, there lies a challenge for the future of the planet, is these religions, are they going to continue to fight with each other, or are they going to learn the way to get on? Now, how do you see things? We seem to be on this planet, well, it's either going to be cataclysmic, or we're going to actually get it right and move into something wonderful.
Well, it's difficult because I don't know. I actually wrote the basic story. In fact, at the end of my story, which is called The Boy Who Heard Music, there's a big concert in New York which is disrupted by, doesn't say who's doing it, but it's disrupted by terrorism. And I wrote this before the 9/11 disaster, so I nearly took it out. And then I thought, no, this isn't about, you know, black predictions. I shouldn't be so conceited. You know, this is just obvious there will be one day terrorism that hits New York. We've lived with it in London for years. So I left it in. The notion is that I carry is I suppose, essentially optimistic. It's balanced. I don't want to be so naive as to say that I think everything will turn out well. But I think if you go back and you look at the religious background behind Judaic faith, behind Islam, they all come from the same place, the same message. And the same message is always very, very, very simple, which is to, you know, love, respect and tolerate each other.
I mean, the thing is these days is we're all together, facing each other and interacting with each other a lot more than we did. The great thing about the World Cup, it might have been spoiled by all the diving and acting going on the pitch, but the way the fans got on together and the way Germany embraced everybody and, you know, there's just a internation party going on was fantastic.
I think that's right. In the art of the rock industry, because it's a bit boy-driven, isn't it, let's be honest, there are a few girls, but not that many. That's changing, of course, but in my day it was mainly boys, and it was very sport-driven, very loyal. You know, if you liked The Who and The Kinks, that was it. You know, you wouldn't have more than maybe two bands that you were crazy about. And there was a strong partisan kind of loyalty which had a sport flavour to it. So that's a form of congregation that I understand. But I still think it's congregation. I think that the higher power, if you like, that they use in recovery circles, the idea of let's not use the God word, let's use the word higher power. The higher power at a football match is the big great God of football, isn't it? And sportsmanship, and you gather together and hopefully, yeah. So a music gig, what Roger and I find that we can exalt when we perform together is the audience. Mm. It's just the audience, you know, and we're constantly brought back to that fact. What they think, what they do, what they feel right now is more important than anything we can.
Well, I know that. I mean, your announcement on stage at Hyde Park was lovely. It was great humility. You know, you kind of honoured and recognised all the younger bands that have been before you. Took the mick about your age, and fact everybody here is older than that. But you thanked, you know, you said it's a great privilege to be here, which is, you know, which is a wonderful thing from somebody of, you know, iconic status, Pete.
I didn't thank the Queen for the use of her garden, but I suppose.
Shall we end on an oldie then? How about that?
Yeah.
Let me see you. Time in life can mean nothing is everything. Everything is nothing is. Please the people, audiences, they break the fences. Nothing is.
Wonderful. Pete Townsend playing live. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.